was the sixth president of the United States, and he wrote a series of letters to one of his boys when his son was away in school in Massachusetts. Nine of those letters were later published in 1848 under the title John Quincy Adams' Letters to His Son About God and the Bible. In the in letter two in that publication, John Adams said there are three points that form, there are three points of doctrine, the belief of which forms the foundation of all morality. Number one, the existence of God. Number two, the immortality of the human spirit. And number three, a future state of rewards and punishments. Now let that sink in for a minute. The life that you are living and the life that your neighbor down the street may be living are based upon a belief system. You might have two neighbors, one who is a Christian who got up this morning, got ready, made his or her way along with the family to Bible school and will be in worship today and this week when the services are held. Maybe a next door neighbor is sleeping in this morning, maybe going to the golf course or maybe out shopping for groceries later today when it's not too crowded, living their lives based on different belief systems. The first one, on the belief system that there is a God in heaven, that that God one day will judge us and will usher us into His home to live with Him forever. That the human being is not just what we can see in the mirror, but is also made in God's image, and there is a part of us that will never die or cease to exist. The neighbor does not hold to the same belief system. What you see is what you get. What you can enjoy here is all that there is to have. And so he lives his life in view of that belief system, enjoying life, treating others in view of only this world and what it can bring and not a future judgment. Jesus closed the Sermon on the Mount by talking about two builders. There was one, and I just described this person in the first scenario, who builds his house or his life upon the foundation of a belief in God and the Spirit and a future reward, a future state of rewards and punishments. That person, Jesus says, is wise. He builds his house upon a rock, and when the storms come and the winds blow and the waters rage, that house stands firm because it was built upon a rock. But the other one I described in the second scenario, maybe the two houses look the same, same number of rooms, same square footage, exterior looks the same, maybe in the same side by side, but one of them differs from the other in that the second one is not on a strong foundation. It's built upon the sand and it cannot stand the storm. The promises of God make the difference in how we live our lives, and the enjoyment that we have here, also the delayed gratification of the anticipation of heaven. That's Matthew 7, 24 to 27 on Jesus' two builders. Now we want to talk today about standing on the promises of God and three reasons why we can stand on that foundation, the promises of God. The first one is, we can stand upon the promises of God because God has a good track record of keeping His promises. I might ask you this question off the top of your head. Can you think of any promise that God ever made that God did not keep? Now I'll let you meditate upon that while we go through these verses, and then we'll come back to it in a few minutes and see if you have, lest I forget, see if you have come up with any answer any time that God has forgotten or failed to keep a promise. Turn with me to Joshua 22, if you will. If you haven't already turned there, some have come in since we asked you to turn there. Joshua is a book that is about the conquering of Canaan. The children of Israel have left the slavery of Egypt. They have made their way across the wilderness, and finally, even though unbelief slowed them down, they have finally made it to their inheritance, the promise that God had long ago made to them that He would give them a land. And you could sum up the entire theme of the book of Joshua with four words that are found in verse 4 of Joshua 22. In fact, you might want to underline these four words and write theme or theme of the book beside them. Joshua 22:4 says, "And now the Lord your God hath given rest unto your brethren as He promised them." That's what the book of Joshua is about. God had made a promise, and the book of Joshua is about God fulfilling that promise. You continue in this passage, "Therefore now return ye, and get you unto your tents and unto the land of your possession, which Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you on the other side Jordan." So here they are now enjoying the fulfillment of the promise that God had made more than four centuries before when He first told Abraham that I'm going to, and He made four promises to Abraham, make your name great. I'm going to make you or your descendant a blessing to all nations or all people. I'm going to give you as many descendants as there are stars in the heavens, and I'm going to give you a land for your descendants to live in. It's that fourth promise, what we call the land promise, that the book of Joshua is about. I have counted no less than 13 times in the book of Genesis where God reiterated that promise first found in Genesis 12, 1 through 7, that He would give the descendants of Abraham a land. You go into the book of Exodus, and I've counted no less than 7 more references to the land promise, and you can find them scattered in the other books of the Pentateuch. God had made this promise, reaffirmed it in succeeding generations, and finally it has now been fulfilled. In Genesis 15, 16, and I think I will give you time to flip over there if you want to, in one of those passages where God makes the land promise to Abraham, we find that He not only told him what He was going to give him, He also told him when He would give it to him. And we also find in many of the other passages that He identifies the land and He tells the inhabitants that are there now who will no longer be allowed to live there later, but in this passage touches on that. So let's read Genesis 15 and verse 16. But in the fourth, let's start in 15. "And thou shalt go to thy fathers in peace. Thou shalt be buried in a good old age. But in the fourth generation, they shall come hither again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full." I'm going to give you this land where you have been a nomad, where you've passed through, but not yet. There is a divine measuring instrument of nations, and the Amorites were a wicked nation, so they were somewhere on the scale, but they had not reached the limit yet. It was not yet a full container. Whenever it got full, God would do away with them and not let them be a nation anymore, and that would happen in the fourth generation. Now you look at the generations Levi, Kohath, Amram. Remember who Amram's son was? Moses. Good, Waylon. Moses. And in that generation, who was it that led the children of Israel out of Egyptian bondage but the fourth generation? Moses led them out, and of course he would have been able to take them in, but because of his sin, he only got to the border, was able to see across, but was not allowed to go in because he disobeyed God. And Joshua, and the book that bears his name, records that Joshua led the children of Israel in to the land of Canaan to fulfill this promise that had been made so many years before. God made a promise. What, can you trust God to keep His promises? Well, He kept that one, didn't He? Even though 400 years plus had passed, God said, "I'm going to give you this land." God gave them the land. Now back to the book of Joshua. Let's notice two passages that show, without any doubt, that God kept every facet of His promise. Let's go to Joshua 21 And we'll read together the last verse, Joshua 21:45. Now, Joshua has led the children of Israel into the land of Canaan. They came in the central part. They conquered the tribes that lived there. Then they went south and they conquered the tribes that lived there. There were some strongholds that were left, but the land was broken. And then they conquered, they went back up and conquered the north. All the land of Canaan had been subdued. And so here you have by Joshua 21, verse 45, there failed not aught of any good thing which the Lord had spoken unto the house of Israel. All came to pass. Did God keep His promises? That passage says, everything God had promised had come to pass. Now Joshua 23, verses 14 and 15, as if that verse weren't enough, we see again this teaching, and behold, this day I am going the way of all the earth, and you know in all your hearts and in all your souls, now picture the old man Joshua, been their leader all these years, maybe stooped and gray, maybe his voice not as strong as it had been, but he's addressing them, and he says, you know, this is true, you've been with me while we've done this, that not one thing hath failed of all the good things which the Lord your God spake concerning you, all have come to pass unto you, and not one thing hath failed thereof. Therefore, it shall come to pass that as all good things are coming to you, which the Lord your God promised you, so shall the Lord bring upon you all evil things until He have destroyed you from off this good land which the Lord your God hath given you. You see, he's making the same point that I'm making this morning in this class. That is, that God's track record also indicates something about His future behavior. He said God kept His promise, just like He said He's given you the land. He's given you everything He said He would give you. But He had also warned them that they would not be allowed to stay in the land unless they were obedient to Him. If they went after other gods, if they became immoral and took on the religions of the land around them, then God would kick them out of the land. Now, Joshua is saying to them, you remember that God keeps His promises. Whether they are positive and rewarding or whether they are threats, God will keep His word. God has a track record of always telling the truth. Now, of course, we see that that happened. They were later carried away. The northern tribes after division into Assyria and the southern tribes into Babylon for 70 years. But they were brought back eventually after they had paid the price for their sins. But God kept that promise, and that's the point. You might also put in your notes or beside that verse that we just read, 1 Kings 8:56, referring back to this time, the Lord, there hath not failed one word of all His good promise. Now back to our question. Has anyone thought of any promise that God has made that God has not kept? Now, there are some promises yet to be enjoyed that relate to heaven and so forth. But I'm not going to wait very long here because I know there are no promises that God has made that God hasn't kept. Now, some promises are conditional, and the conditions are not met. Therefore, God is not obligated to keep those promises. So the first reason that we can stand on the promises of God is that God has a good track record. Now, let's go to the New Testament for our second point. Go to 2 Corinthians the first chapter. We can stand on the promises of God this morning because they are made by reliable sources. You know, if someone makes a promise to you, you will assign value to it according to how you view that person. I mean, if it is someone who has proved himself or herself trustworthy in the past, they've always done what they said they would do, they tell you they'll do something, then you'll put a lot of stock in that. If there is someone who has disappointed you a lot of times before and they make another promise, you probably won't put very much stock in it. It's not a reliable source for a promise. So the promises of God, do they come from reliable sources? Now obviously, from God Himself, but I want to look at the mouthpiece of the promises. I mentioned 2 Corinthians 1, and I'll be there in just a minute, but just for your notes, Luke 21, 33, Jesus Christ Himself said, "Heaven and earth shall pass away, But my word, or words, shall not pass away. Now, Jesus lived on the earth for 33 years, and He never one time told a lie. He never one time deceived anybody. He's been back in heaven now for 2,000 years, and He still hasn't told the first lie. Now, Jesus said, the ground under your feet is not as secure, as sure as the words that I give to you. The air that you're breathing or that is above you is not as sure, is not as reliable as the words that I have given you. Heaven and earth will pass away. They're not going to last forever. But my words will never grow old. They will never, the shelf life will never end for them. They will always be powerful. That's Luke 21:33. Now we see not only has Jesus made promises, revealed the promises of God to us, but the apostles of Jesus revealed the promises of God to us. And that's 2 Corinthians. If you have studied 2 Corinthians before, and especially recently, you probably remember that 2 Corinthians has a lot of material where Paul is defending his apostleship. There were those false teachers who were trying to turn the hearts of the converts that Paul had made and that he had influenced, that others had made in Corinth, away from him. And they were denying that Paul was a real apostle. You know, he wasn't one of the original 12. He was an apostle born out of due season. And some seized upon that because they did not like Paul's authority and what he said. So they tried to discount the messenger so that the message would not have any weight. And really it is important, and you see that here in 2 Corinthians, that the one who is delivering the message have a good reputation among those who are receiving the message. That is, if they did not respect Paul, then this letter would not be held in any esteem when they received it. They would say, well, that's from Paul, and he's not really an apostle anyway. They might not even read it, or if they read it, they might not obey it. And so Paul took the time to defend his apostleship. Now, the thing that the first chapter, his enemies were saying about him is that earlier Paul had indicated to the Corinthians that he was going to come see them. And then he was going to go from them on into Macedonia. And then he would come back and see them again and they could help him go on his journey. But circumstances changed and Paul never made that trip. His enemies seized upon that and they said, you see, Paul, it can't be trusted. Paul said he was going to come, but he did not come. He's wishy-washy. He's fickle. He is a deceiver. You can't put any stock in anything Paul says. He's not a true apostle. Now, how is Paul going to answer that? Well, Paul answers it this way. He says, in effect, God trusts me, so you can trust me too. He said, God has given me His Spirit. God has sealed me. God has anointed me. And if God would God put all those blessings upon a man who was not trustworthy or who was not a fit mouthpiece, who was not a true apostle? And the answer to that, of course, is no. You see that in verse 21. Now he which establisheth us with you is Christ, and hath anointed us is God, who hath also sealed us and given us the earnest of the Spirit in our hearts. Moreover, I call God for a record upon my soul, that to spare you I came not as yet unto Corinth, not for that we might have, or we have dominion over your faith, but are helpers of your joy, for by faith you stand. Paul said, there was a reason why I didn't come. Circumstances changed. Also, I wanted to come under better circumstances. Now, in that context, and that's not really our point this morning, but you needed to see that context in order to appreciate verse 20. And verse 20 is our point. As you observe that God's promise, we can stand on God's promises because they come from credible sources, from apostles. And here's Paul For all the promises, I'm in 2 Corinthians 1:20, of God in Him are yea, and in Him amen, unto the glory of God by us. By us, the apostles, the writers of the New Testament, making known the promises of God. Can those promises be trusted? Can you put any stock in them? Can you latch onto them? Can you build your life around them? Paul said they are yea. That is, they are to be trusted. I will affirm that they are the beginning and the end. They'll be here at the beginning of your faith. They will be here on the last day of your earthly sojourn. All the promises of God in Him are established. They are yea and amen. So, do we have a good reason to trust the promises of God? Yes, because they come from reliable sources. You also see in 2 Peter chapter 3, if you'd like to turn, we see another apostle talking about the promises of God. He also was facing opposition. This is Peter. Peter, in 2 Peter 3, is talking about the second coming of Jesus. And there were some scoffers then, as there are now, who did not believe in Jesus. They did not believe that Jesus was going to come back to earth, even if they believed that there was a historical character named Jesus who lived. He's dead, he's buried, he's not in heaven, he's not coming back to take us home. That's pie in the sky, by and by. That theology, that belief system won't cut it. And if you believe in that, then you know you're really not intellectual, you're not really very wise. You should live with the philosophy of eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. I mean, that's what we have. You have that here in 2 Peter 3, where Peter writes that he's going to stir up their pure minds by way of remembrance. He said, you know this, but there have been some who've been casting doubts upon it. Some who may have caused your faith to waver. Now, I don't know where you are in here this morning. I received an email from someone in another state last night. He was a preacher of the gospel, but his faith has begun to waver. And he is reaching out for some help. I'm very thankful that he is. And he got to reading the wrong blogs and following the wrong people on Facebook. People who don't believe in the inspiration of the Bible. People who do not believe in the distinctive doctrine of the New Testament church. And he's coming back. He's seen that's a cistern, broken cistern that can hold no water. But you know, if it can happen to him, and he's trained, he's had good education, he comes from a good family, it could happen to us. We get to following the wrong people, we get influenced by the wrong theology, we can have our doubts. We need to be careful about that. That's what happened here in 2 Peter chapter 3, when Peter says they're scoffers, verse 2, that ye may be mindful of these words which are spoken before by the holy prophets and the commandment of the apostles of the Lord and Savior, knowing this first, verse 3, that there shall come in the last days scoffers, walking after their own lust, and saying, where is the promise of His coming? They're not saying, would you tell me the verse where Jesus said He's coming back? That's not what they're saying. What they're saying is, where is the fulfillment of that promise? I mean, He said He was coming back, but He's not here. It's been a long time. You know, today, someone say, well, you know, it's been 2,000 years. You Christians don't really believe that after 2,000 years that promise holds any value, that Jesus is going to come back. I mean, if He was going to come back, He would have already come back. It's been too long. And saying, where is the promise of His coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation. Now, they make two arguments against the promise of God, the promise of the second coming. The first one is what we could call the time argument. I just described that. It's been too long. God's not going to keep that promise. The second one is the continuity argument. That is, everything is always continued along just like it is right now, no interruption. Therefore, the implication is it will always continue as it is, no interruption. Second coming of Christ would be an interruption. burning up the world would be an interruption. That's not going to happen. It's never happened before. It's always been uniformitarianism is the word we would assign it today, or that people call it today. It's interesting how these arguments, arguments against God don't really change. I mean, this has been made 2,000 years ago. People still saying it. Same thing. They think they thought of something good, something new. No, it was in the Bible. It's already been answered. And Peter answers it in reverse order. He says to them, well, about the continuity argument, did you forget there was a flood? That was an interruption, Genesis 6 through 9. When the fountains of great deep were broken up, the waters of the heavens came forth, the whole earth was flooded, every land-dwelling, air-breathing animal and human on earth died, except the ones on the ark. 365 days, the earth was flooded, the waters began to abate, finally the ark came to rest on Mount Ararat, finally Noah and his family were able to get off the ark and they repopulated the earth, and the animals repopulated their populations or species on the earth, and here we've gotten back to where we were, but there was an interruption. Therefore, your second argument doesn't stand. Things have been interrupted before, therefore they can be and will be again. The second argument, the time argument, he answers. He said, a day with the Lord is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day. Verse 8. What does that mean? Does that mean that when 24 hours pass here on earth, that God somehow goes to a divine heavenly calendar and marks off 1,000 years? No, that's not what it means. What it means is that God lives outside the realm of time. We're bound by a clock and a calendar, but God isn't. He's talking about a promise that God made. God is just as likely to keep a promise that is 1,000 years old as He is to keep a promise that's one day old. 1,000 years is just one day. Now, you and I, if we don't keep our promises within a reasonable time, we might forget them. But does God forget? We might lose the ability to keep them. We might run out of money, or our health might change. Does God ever run out of resources? Does His health ever fail? No. So you see, they were wrong on both points. Continuity argument? Nope. Time argument? No. So he brings us to this conclusion, 2 Peter 3, verse 9. The Lord is not slack concerning His promise. Now be careful how you quote that. I'm sure I've made this mistake before. It's not promises, is it? That would be true. And that's really the overall point that we're making here. But what it actually says, we must be careful to quote the Bible accurately. Promise. When we quote the Bible, we must quote it in the proper tense, past, present, or future, and the proper number, singular or plural, nouns and verbs. Because you could teach false doctrine without changing anything but the tense of a verb or the number of a noun. And denominational people do that. Or they'll quote it from memory and they'll substitute a single word. Sounds about the same, but the meaning is not the same. To be good students of the Bible, we must quote the Bible accurately. And must interpret it as it's written and not as we twist it or change it. At any rate, the Lord is not slack concerning His promise, the promise of the second coming, in other words, as some men count slackness. In other words, God is not, say something and forget it. He doesn't deal loosely. You know, He remembers everything He says and intends to keep it. As some men count slackness, but His long-suffering to us was, why has He waited all this time? It's not, as the scoffers say, because He doesn't intend to keep the promise. Why has He waited? Because He wants heaven to have more people in it. He's giving us time to get the gospel out to the world, to bring more people into the ark of safety, so that when that time does come, when Jesus returns, and the door of opportunity is closed, and no more people, not a single person can be saved because the end has come, well, it won't be just a few, but it'll be more. You see, He's counting on us to fill up heaven's mansions, if you wanted to say it that way.
He's counting on us while we got an opportunity to reach our neighbors and our friends and our brothers and our sisters and our cousins and our grandchildren and the world. Not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. But the day of the Lord will come. You could take that to the bank. It's a promise of God. As a thief in the night, unannounced and unexpected, in the which the heavens shall pass away with a great noise. Remember Jesus said, heaven and earth shall pass away? It won't go unnoticed. It'll be loud. And the elements shall melt with fervent heat. The earth composed of elements. The earth also and the works that are therein shall be burned up. Seeing then that all these things shall be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in all holy conversation and godliness? Remember how we began this lesson? That what we believe affects how we live? That's what he's saying there. Since we know that's coming, since we understand this earth is not forever and that Jesus is coming back one day, what manner of persons ought you to be? The kind of person, like the neighbor I said to the Christian in the beginning, just lives for this world, sleeps in this morning, you know, get to the restaurant ahead of all the church people, get to Walmart while it's not crowded, you know, drunk last night, sleep in today, just because this world's all... Is that really wise in view of the fact that Jesus is coming again? No, that's foolish. Then 12, looking for and hasting unto the coming of the day of God. We don't dread it. We're excited about it. We want it to come. Wherein the heavens shall be on fire, the heavens being on fire shall be dissolved, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. Nevertheless, according to His promise, look for a new heavens and a new earth wherein dwelleth righteousness. Of course, that's our eternal home in heaven. All right, that's all we'll say about that. Let's move on then to number three. We can stand on the promises of God, number three, because they stand upon four great pillars. Four great pillars. Foundations are important. If you were going to build a house, some of you have. If you were involved in the building of, a skyscraper in a great city, much emphasis, time, and expense would go into what we might call a hole in the ground that will never be seen by any of the passing people that walk the streets beside that skyscraper later. You might think if you're building a house, you know, do we really have to put all this money into a foundation? Yes, because the superstructure, the building will only be as strong as its foundation. And so they'll test the soil. They may dig out that soil and bring in other materials such as gravel, rock. Then they will pour concrete depending on how much weight is going to be on it, how many stories it may have to be. Inches or feet deep. They will reinforce it according to specifications with rebar and iron metal so it'll be even stronger than it would be otherwise. They have to sit for a while, especially if you fill in so that it doesn't settle and crack the foundation later. And then they'll build on that. Foundations are important. Foundations are important when it comes to the promises of God. Is there anything under them holding them up? Yes, the character of God holds them up. And there are four great pillars of the character of God that uphold the promises of God. I'll give them to you and then we'll discuss them. The omniscience of God, the omnipotence of God, the omnibenevolence of God, and the integrity of God. Now what does that mean? Those are big words that we probably haven't used in conversation yet today. What do they mean? Omniscience. That's God's power to know all. Omnipotence. That's God's power to do all. Omnibenevolence. That refers, say this exactly as I want to, God's unlimited goodness. God's integrity. That refers to God's impeccable character. Now, the Bible teaches each of those in a number of places. Just consider with me a verse for each one of them. Hebrews 4:13, talking about the omniscience of God. All things are naked and open unto Him with whom we have to do. God knows everything. Now, when it comes to a promise then, does God ever make any mistakes in issuing a promise because He was ill-informed or forgot something or did not know what was really needed? No, He's omniscient. Can't do that. The omnipotence of God. God's power to do all. Jeremiah 32:17, there is nothing too hard for thee. Luke 1:37, nothing is impossible to God. So, does God ever get excited about a situation or see a need and say, I'll do this, and then later think, oh, I can't do that like we do? No, He has the power to fulfill any promise He ever makes. God's omnibenevolence, His goodness. You know, stores will bait and switch. Oh, it looks pretty good on the commercial. But you get there, oh, sorry, we're sold out of that. Or, no, it's not that one, it's this one. Does God tantalize us with mirages, with something that appears to be better than it? No, He can't do that because His love forbids it. And then God's integrity. God's faith, 1 John 4:7-10 on that previous point. And then God's integrity. Titus 1:2, God cannot lie. He can't lie. It's not possible for Him to do it. And then 1 Corinthians 1:9, God is faithful. He cannot fail to keep a promise because He's faithful. That's who He is. Now, having said that, let's make the application. If I doubt any of the promises of God, I am committing a very serious offense because I am reflecting upon the character of God. Let me illustrate it, then I'll come back to the point. I'm going to assume, and I think that'd be the case with most of us in here, that we had good, loving parents, did the best they could for us. Now, would it have hurt your parents' feelings if you somehow expressed to them that you didn't think they actually loved you? If you said to them, well, I can't trust you to take care of me. If somehow we reflected on their character, oh, it would have torn them up. If our children said something like that to us, it would be very offensive. And that's us with our limitations. And we know we're not perfect in any of those areas. But what does it feel like to God for Him to say, I'll do this for you, and then for us to say, it's never going to happen. I mean, it might be true for somebody else, but it's not happened for me. What am I saying when I say God's not going to keep a promise? Am I saying, well, God forgot that one? Am I saying, well, God meant well, but He just can't make it happen. It's too hard for Him. Am I saying that God, you know, He painted a really pretty picture, but it didn't turn out that way for me? Or am I saying that God is fickle? And sometimes He does what He says, and sometimes He don't, or doesn't. You see, we can stand on the promises of God because they are upheld by the character of God. A.W. Tozer said this, and I've been mulling this over for a couple of days. I believe it's the truth. What comes to our minds when we think of God is the most important thing about us. Let that wash over you for a moment. What we think of when we think of God is the most important thing about us. I know this is true. One's concept of God determines how he worships and how he lives. You don't have to look any farther than the pagans. Those who worshipped the god of war, what kind of lives did they live? They were warlike people. Those who worshipped gods of lust, what kind of worship did they have?
Well, they brought their lust right into the worship with them. Those who worship gods of revenge, what do they have in high esteem? But treachery and getting even. But those who worship the God of love, how do they live? You see, our concept of God will determine how we worship. We worship according to the Bible if we believe the God of the Bible, and it will determine how we live. Therefore, what comes to our mind when we think of God is the most important thing about us. Well, I thought I would close, and we have just 3 minutes, by looking at some of the promises of God. We can stand on them. We've established that. What are some of the promises? Number one, we have the promise of providence. Romans 8:28, all things work together for good to those who love God, who are the called according to His purpose. Number two, we have the promise of care. 1 Peter 5:7, casting all your care upon Him, for He careth for you. One translation has this, the last part of it. He makes you His care. Isn't that beautiful? I remember hearing Brother Winkler say that he heard an elder say of Burton Kaufman one time. I don't know if anybody here ever met Brother Kaufman, but you may have his commentary set in your library. He preached up in New York, out in Texas. But he said, the elder said of Kaufman, he said, I think I found out the secret of Brother Kaufman. He said, there are a lot of other preachers I'd rather hear than him. And he wasn't of great stature, small man. Nothing to impress physically, in other words. But the elder said, when you are with him, you are the most important person in the world. That's a good trait to have because it shows that you care about others, that empathy. Well, that's an illustration of this. When you're with God, you're the most important person in the world. And you're always with Him. Isn't that beautiful? A third promise. We have the promise of His personal presence and participation in our lives. I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. Hebrews 13:5 and 6. You know, the most mundane task, the most boring job, the most outside the box day of your life, you didn't go through it by yourself. God was with you. I mean, that can make life exciting and a glorious experience no matter what the circumstances are, because God's with me today. What is there that God's wanting me to do in this situation? What blessing does God have waiting for me right now? God's always with us. Daily participation. A little boy came home. His mom had been sick and didn't get to go to worship that day. And she said, what did the preacher preach on today? And he said, the preacher said we were going to get a new quilt. She looked at him. She said, what verse did he use to say that? And he said, he talked about Jesus is going to send us a comforter. Well, that's a promise to the apostles. But he did promise to comfort us, didn't he? In our Psalm 23. Well, I'll close with this. He will help us bear every burden of service, lift every load of care, climb every mountain of difficulty, ford every stream of challenge, breach every wall of opposition, and win every battle we face. You can stand on the promises of God. We'll be dismissed.